You're listening to an IOE podcast,
powered by UCL Minds.
This is Research for the Real World. Conversations with researchers about the paths they've taken to shape our everyday lives.
This is Research for the Real World. Conversations with researchers about the paths they've taken to help shape everyday lives. Hi, I'm Jo Nicol, and I'm a lecturer in science education here at IOE, UCL's Faculty of Education and Society. In this season of Research for the Real World, we are discussing how the cost of living and food insecurity is affecting children and young people's life chances, specifically food banks in schools and the impact of this economic crisis on children's learning. On this episode, I'm delighted to be talking to Professor Alice Bradbury. Alice is Professor of Sociology of Education in the Department of Education, Practice and Society at IOE. Previously, Alice also worked as a primary school teacher, which helps shape her research focus and priorities. She has been named as one of the IOE researchers that features in Elsevier's and Stanford University's list of the world's most cited scholars. She specialises in research on the impact of policy on primary schools and inequalities, with a particular focus on issues of assessment in early years and primary schools. However, her current research focuses on educational responses to the cost of living crisis. She has recently published a report on food banks and schools and is here with us today to give us an insight into this research. Alice, welcome back to the podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me again.
So I'm going to start with, I know you've been on the podcast before, talking about your work with schools during the COVID period, but if you can quickly remind us of how you became involved in education and working at the IOE.
Well, like many people at the IOE, I was a primary school teacher. I did a PGCE straight out of university. And then during the time I was a teacher in London, in King's Cross, and then in Tower Hamlets, I got really interested in sort of social aspects of education and the differences between different groups, which was something that had kind of always been an interest of mine. And so I did my master's at the Institute in the evenings as a part-time student, and then did a PhD and got kind of sucked into the world of educational research. And I haven't ever really left since.
And tell us about the focus of your research over that time. Has it evolved much?
Well, all of my research is about policy and inequality. And sometimes it's sort of more one than the other. And taken me into looking at things like how assessments shape what teachers do in the classroom, how it affects early years as well as schools. I tend to kind of straddle across early years and primary, which obviously are very different, but there are some very similar themes. So there are kind of different directions I go in, but the kind of central two kind of core things are always about policy and inequality, because really what I'm interested in is how does what the government is deciding about education play out in the real lives of schools and teachers and families? And then how does that have different impacts on different groups in society, particularly issues to do with racial inequality and social class?
And these two broad areas of policy and inequality obviously feed into this cost of the living crisis. And I wonder, how does the crisis, from your perspective, impact children?
Well, I mean, this is how I got really interested in this issue about food banks, was because during COVID, we did a lot of research that I talked about in the previous podcast and found that food was one of the things that schools were providing all the time to families, because they were used to providing it as free school meals, but they were finding that they were food became kind of one of the big issues when schools shut, or schools sort of shut to most pupils, I should say. So that kind of period of crisis is something which I think was really interesting in terms of how schools have responded. And I've written about how schools have kind of enacted policy during that period in this kind of crisis mode. After COVID came, you know, a period where for many people, the problems didn't go away because the cost of living crisis increased food bills, inflation, high energy costs. For many people, that period was also very difficult, continues to be now. So, you know, I was really, you know, interested in how schools sort of stepped in during the COVID period and then how they were continuing to step in afterwards. You know, that the crisis in many places had not gone away in terms of providing food for children. So, you know, we have an existing, you know, huge amount of research about the impact of nutrition and hunger on children and their learning. We know that children learn better when they're not hungry. So it makes sense in this period when we know there was increasing child poverty, increasing family food insecurity, to be concerned about how that might be affecting children in schools. And actually, since we've been doing the research, there's been a lot more research, kind of larger scale studies and things, larger scale surveys of how many schools are doing things like operating food banks. And a lot of that has shown it has really increased in the last couple of years.
Wow. And how do these food banks in schools work?
Well, with this project, we wanted to kind of look in depth. So we went to 6 schools around England to find out how it worked in their schools. And we spoke to the head and to other staff members involved and to teachers. We decided not to talk to parents because we didn't want to kind of further burden the users of the food bank with asking them to do interviews. So we talked to all of the staff. We wanted to know how it worked, who was doing it, you know, how did they operate? And there is some variation, but in general, the kind of normal model is that the school gets food either from an organisation like Fair Share or City Harvest or the Felix Project, who get food which was otherwise going to be thrown away from supermarkets and so on. And they give it to schools, they distribute it to schools. The school then puts it in a room and parents come in usually one day a week and pick up what they need. There are some variations in that in some schools they're not using those organisations, those food share organisations, but they're just doing it through donations and buying the food themselves. But that's the kind of general pattern. So parents are invited to come along if, you know, anyone knows that they are struggling, but also often the food bank is just advertised to parents in general so that they can use it if they are really struggling to buy food.
Wow. How did the project come about?
Well, following on from the COVID projects, I got some funding from the British Education Research Association to look into this phenomenon of food banks in schools. So with my research assistant, Sharon Vince, we embarked on this project, which was looking at 6 different schools, all of whom had food banks. And at each school, we talked to the head teacher, the teachers, and any staff involved in the food banks as well. We decided that we didn't want to talk to the actual users of the food bank, the parents and families, because we didn't want to kind of add any burden. And really what we wanted to focus on was how the food bank was operating in the school and the impact it was having from the point of view of the teachers.
And in terms of, I'm just thinking, the location of a school is obviously in one way convenient for the parents. Does this feed in? Why does the location and how does the location help the parents?
The location really helps because obviously parents are already there picking up their children, and these were primary schools. So I think the situation is slightly different in secondary, but in the primary schools we looked at, and then also in the nurseries that we've looked at in our kind of early years sister project, obviously the parents are there twice a day. So it's very convenient. And also it doesn't have the stigma of going to a food bank in a church hall or a community centre, and you don't need a voucher. So often for like a Trussell Trust food bank, you need a voucher to qualify, which you take along. The school food banks are just on a whoever says they need it basis. So people can just come along and if they want to, they don't have to sort of qualify for the school food bank. So that is a really important factor in allowing people who are food insecure to come and access food in a way that is not making them feel those feelings of stigma and shame, which the research about food banks in general shows is a huge barrier to people accessing food. We also found examples of where it was also much, much easier than accessing a food bank somewhere else, because for some parents, there were cultural reasons, like they didn't want to go to a church or to a mosque to get food. For other parents, it was simply that they were able to get to the school. So the food bank that they might have been able to access otherwise was a bus ride away, and they couldn't afford the bus. They couldn't walk with the heavy bags. You know, there's a lot of kind of practical reasons, especially if you've got several small children, why you might not want to go to a food bank a long way away. And in the more rural areas, that was also an important factor. They were close to the school.
You briefly spoke earlier about the impact that hunger and the lack of food that children can have has on their learning. And I wonder what you know and what you found about the impact of the cost of the living crisis on learning and participation in school.
I think we currently don't really know or understand the kind of scale of impact, I'd say, of the cost of living crisis on children. What we do know is from these schools and from the nurseries that having food available does help with children's learning. So when we asked all of the teachers about does it make any difference, they said, first of all, straight away, it makes a difference in terms of concentration, motivation, attendance. It makes a difference to all of those aspects of kind of school life, which many children are kind of taken for granted. So, of course, the schools weren't just providing food. They were also providing uniform, shoes, equipment, you know, toiletries and so on. So it was making a big difference also in terms of their participation in school, as well as their learning. So it was children being able to run in the playground because they had shoes that fitted them, and children feeling like they could join in because they had the same uniform as everyone else and they didn't feel different. It was about kind of dignity and well-being and participating in sort of normal events like having a Christmas jumper on Christmas Jumper Day. You know, it was those aspects as well as being able to concentrate. And the other thing that came out quite clearly in terms of well-being was that children whose parents were accessing the food bank were also had higher well-being because their families aren't stressed. Their parents aren't worrying about where the next meal comes from. And so the child isn't worrying about their mum who's getting thin, or worrying about their little brothers and sisters having enough food. So then they could concentrate at school because they're generally much happier and more content. So it's got a very complex and kind of multifaceted impact actually on the child, where the parents are feeling more secure in terms of food.
It just struck me there as being the burden that's on these children's shoulders sometimes. You know, hearing, I'm sure that some of these stories that you found out from the research, that thinking about seeing their mum get thin or worrying where their food's coming from.
Yeah, I think it's important to say that some of the stories are really shocking and really upsetting, actually, hearing about families that are in real financial difficulty, families that have been made homeless, you know, families that are struggling with domestic violence and then ending up in temporary accommodation where they can't cook and they need to be supported in terms of food so that the children get an evening meal. You know, all of these stories are really upsetting. And I think underlying this, we have to remember that there is a huge social problem, which is children living in poverty, which we shouldn't normalize. You know, this is one of the things I want to do with this research, is draw attention to how much schools are doing to cope with a problem which ought to be fixed.
Shouldn't be their problem.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so you say there that the schools have been doing a lot of the work here. What kind of work is being done by the schools to help with this?
Well, it takes up quite a lot of time and energy, obviously, because a member of staff, and usually that there's one member of staff who tends to be running the whole thing, a member of staff has to organise the deliveries, find the food, move the food into whatever kind of location. You need a room which parents can access safely. You need fridge, you need shelving. You know, there's a huge amount of kind of resource that has to go into this. And in some cases, of course, you have to also pay for the food and pay for the delivery. So there is a huge kind of financial and time input from the schools. And in some cases, as well as the food bank, we found head teachers who were spending, you know, huge amounts of time on kind of welfare related work, you know, finding families places to stay or allowing them to paying for a bus pass so that the children could get to school. You know, there's a huge amount of work being done accessing grants and finding these companies that will give you free breakfasts for your school pupils. There's a huge amount of work being done in order to keep this provision going and to make sure it's there for these families, because all the schools were really acutely aware how precarious some of this was and how vulnerable the families would be if it got taken away. So they were all working really hard, often spending like a good chunk of time doing all of this kind of propping up the welfare state.
Did you get a sense from the head teachers the level of how this is impacting on their daily duties of being a head teacher at all?
Yeah, so for these head teachers, it was often a really significant thing. You know, they were spending a lot of time dealing with issues caused by, well, not just the cost of living crisis, but by disadvantage and deprivation amongst their pupils. There was also a kind of, I mean, quite apart from the fact that they thought they ought to do it morally, they also said there was real benefits for the school because they built much stronger relationships with the parents. And the food bank itself was a good moment in which a member of staff can talk to parents and find out what's going on and find ways to help. So there were kind of advantages for the school, not just for the children being happier, but also in terms of building those relationships. But there were some questions amongst not just the heads, but other staff about, is this what school should be doing? Should we be stepping beyond our kind of core purpose? And often a feeling that we shouldn't have to, but if no one else is going to do it, then we are the ones here seeing these children faced with the problem every day. So there was a kind of, if not us, then who sort of attitude, and a real sense that we can't let these children down. We've got to do this because we're their main place they go other than home.
Yeah, they have that relationship with them. And it sounds similar. I know you've been on the podcast before and you were talking about the work that schools were doing during the COVID period, and they took on a lot, didn't they, of the other burdens and support networks that were not as accessible to students or children during COVID times. It sounds similar to that again, doesn't it?
Yeah, and interestingly though, we asked about how the food banks were set up, and we thought, I mean, several of them were set up during COVID and carried on, but several of them had existed for a long time and they had always been supporting parents, well, for the last 10 years or so. And for them, it was much more about austerity, changes in benefit policy, changes in housing policy, things like that, that had caused the problem. And COVID came along, but they were always doing that stuff anyway. So there were, you know, I think we have to remember that this is, you know, children living in poverty is not just a product of COVID and the cost of living crisis. It's also a product of social policy over a longer period.
And just, it would be interesting to get your insight onto, you mentioned about the extra work that goes into this, you know, and the extra pressures on staff in order to support this, practical aspects, time aspects, and things like that. But ultimately, it shouldn't be their job. But the convenience of having that location for parents, how much of a role should schools be playing in supporting these things?
I think the problem with the amount of work that is being done in schools to support families with food and all these other things is that there is a very unequal burden on schools. So obviously, some schools are doing a lot. Some schools don't have to do this stuff at all. And we talked to the head teachers particularly about, you know, do you feel this work is recognised? And they said, no, you know, we do so much, and yet all Ofsted care about is our, you know, our curriculum, our SATs results. No one is recognising or kind of even funding all of this extra work. So there is a real risk, I would say, in terms of the system, that we risk exacerbating those inequalities between schools in different areas because, you know, we don't kind of take into account the amount of extra work that some of these schools are having to do to just get their pupils there, to get them in a position where they can learn at the start of the day. So I think there is a kind of bigger sort of question about how much Ofsted should be taking into account these welfare services that schools provide when they judge the effectiveness of the school. Because in these schools, the key thing that they were doing before they could even think about learning was making sure everyone was fed. So, you know, we can't take that away when you're thinking about the impact of a school in its community.
Yeah, it seems quite important, doesn't it, to start with those priorities.
So one of the recommendations that we have is that Ofsted should take into account how much schools are doing in order to care for their communities.
Yeah. Are there schools across the UK that have been hit harder by the cost of living crisis than others?
Well, obviously, schools that were already in areas of deprivation tend to be worse hit. There was some NFER research recently that said that, in fact, about 70% of schools are offering some form of free food parcels or a food bank, which is a very high proportion of schools. And obviously, in areas of higher deprivation, that is even more of the schools. So I think it is across the UK. Our research was in different regions of England, some in schools in London and some around England. And we did find slightly different stories about how the food banks worked, as I said, and why they matter in more rural areas than in the city. We found slightly different issues in terms of different communities and how they access the food bank. But the fundamental problem that the schools in our study were facing, and indeed the same with the nurseries, was simply families not having enough money to give their children enough food.
I mean, it's such important work that you're doing. I wonder what's next for you, Alice?
So we are just finishing off the project, which is about food banks in early years settings. So that's nurseries and preschools and children's centres. And that is slightly different from schools. We are finding that there is a more of an emphasis on children's development. So they need good food in order to be able to develop well when they're smaller. So that's a slight difference, and a slightly different relationship with the parents as well. But equally, we're finding, you know, nurseries doing huge amounts of provision for families who are struggling. So on the positive side, I think what we can see in terms of these case studies we have of how food banks work in schools is a really positive, hopeful story about how much different schools can make to children, that they can be the service that is supporting them in all aspects of their life, but also supporting their family and, you know, really enhancing the child's well-being in, you know, so many different ways. And I think we have to remember that is often down to the dedication and sheer hard work of really amazing school staff.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Alice. And thanks to all of those schools out there that are doing such phenomenal work beyond what should be expected of them. Thank you. It's been really interesting to have you on the show and interesting to learn more about your career and your research. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me back.
You can follow Alice on X, the website formerly known as Twitter, at Alice J. Bradbury. That's at AliceJBradbury to learn more about her research. Some of what we've covered today is also available in the episode notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, we have an archive of 20 past seasons. Search IOE Podcast from wherever you get your podcasts to find episodes of Research for the Real World, as well as more podcasts from IOE. Oh, and a quick favour before you go. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, we'd really appreciate it if you could give the IOE podcast a rating. 5 stars would be nice if you're enjoying the show. And that will help us to reach more people who are interested in hearing about such important work. I'm Jo. Thanks for listening.
Research for the Real World is produced by IOE Marketing and Communications and IOE Research Development. The theme music was created by Rob Cochran. Tatiana Sotero-Diaz is the series advisor. Amy Leibowitz is the series producer. And Jason Ilagan is the executive producer of the IOE podcast.
much for downloading and listening to this IOE podcast.